Thanks for listening to the Greater Boston Startup Culture Podcast. This podcast is a production of Culture Envy, LLC. I'm Corey McAvini, and you can learn more about the startup culture conversation at www.cultureenvy.com. Nobody's willing to admit? Come on. Okay, great. Welcome. And how many of you in the audience are entrepreneurs? And how many of you help drive your organization's culture? I should see everybody's in the room. It recently occurred to me that there aren't an awful lot of designated startup culture talks in the area. And it's nothing quite like our startup culture meetup. And I think that's why it's become so popular, just even more so since the new year. And tonight's guests wear many hats. We'll be focusing on their own roles as leaders of culture within their own companies, but also within the greater startup community. And really, that's why we're here tonight, because we're all wondering how we can participate in our community and build a strong culture within our own individual organizations. And we really like to support these endeavors and host these events so that we can take on the challenges that come with our fast pace, high growth environment, and really strengthen the culture and ties within our community. And so I'd just like to say thanks again for joining us this evening, and I really look forward to seeing you at startup culture events throughout the year. And before we dive into our discussion, please allow me to introduce Dr. Felix Mosner, sitting in the front row.
Corey, thank you very much. Do you hear me?
Yes.
I think it's fine.
Okay.
So thank you very much for coming tonight. It's really a big pleasure to welcome all of you. And again, it's I think the third time we host actually the startup culture meeting, actually initiated by Corey McAvini, and we really like to support this initiative. My name is Felix Möss. I'm the CEO of SwissNex, which is a science consulate of Switzerland. As you know, our country is in the middle of Europe, so we have no sea and we have no natural resources. So why is it that we overcome borders and even conquer the world in the world's largest solar plane or even in the biggest solar boat? So one of the reasons is you have to invest in brains and be able to create smart innovations, and this is one of the endeavors what we do around the world in six locations, like this one here. So this is the first science consulate that has been founded with entrepreneurial spirit. So we have to run this like a company, and we have six. So that means San Francisco joined. We have one in Singapore, Shanghai, Bangalore, and in Brazil. And what do? So we try to go out in these very dynamic regions, show the best of Switzerland, connect the dots in education, research, and innovation, and bring the people together. So one of our activities is also definitely in the field of startups, and this is the reason why we also have Nicolo Iorno and his small team with us. So he... I would like to give him afterwards a 1 minute to promote one of the events, if you allow, which is very much in line of the startup culture movements in those developments. But before that, once again, I really would like to thank you, Corey, to make this once again possible. And needless to say, startup culture is really important if you want to have a successful young company. So, but now I would like to give the floor to Nicolo to give the pitch on the Quantialisms.
Okay, thank you very much. So, welcome everyone, also from my side. It's really a pleasure to see so many entrepreneurs in this room. Yes, Felix mentioned we have a bunch of activities in terms of entrepreneurship and innovation. I myself am a project leader in innovation and entrepreneurship, and I work a lot with startups from here, but of course from Switzerland. So once a year, and that's the program he was talking about, we bring over to Boston, this year actually, to Boston and New York, the Swiss National Startup Team. It's like a selection of 20 of the brightest entrepreneurs in Switzerland, which win like the chance to plant really in this ecosystem for 10 days. And we bring them through like a series of workshops, a series of one-to-one mentorships. We partner them up with other startups. We run many, many events so that they gain in terms of visibility. We have, at the end of the entire program, when we think they are mature enough to present in front of investors, we have a competition, which is called like the Global Pitch Fest. We are running that at Mass Challenge. And yeah, they pitch for 1 minute with one slide in front of a crowd of 500 plus people. And they pitch versus American startup companies. And yeah, some nice prizes to win, some flights to Switzerland. And there, I think for you, it might be really nice to connect with those folks. You might find some synergies. And yeah, then the event is pretty fun, at least the last. And then we have on a rolling basis, startups coming here for U.S. market entry purposes. So we host them here in our offices. We have an office space, and we have them out in whatever they need. So the request that they might have varies a lot. And that's in a nutshell what we are doing with startups. These are the structured programs, but of course, if you have Swiss startups coming over and needing any particular help, we are happy to have them out. So that's the video that Felix was mentioning. And now I think,
yes, actually more than 300 startups already came from Switzerland, came over the doorsteps here. So Nicolas is really the person, if you need something in that terms, to reach out to the
SwissNex is our really awesome sponsor. I just want to thank them again. The whole SwissNex team works tirelessly to provide this great space as well as the refreshments afterwards. So I hope you'll stay and join us after the discussion. Let me just introduce this evening's speakers. We've got a whole bunch of great questions coming down the pipeline. So really excited to introduce. I'll start with Gary on the end. Gary Fortier is the COO over at Raise Labs. And to his right is Ben Thomas, the VP of Security at Backalify. And to his right is Susan Hunt-Stevens, the founder and CEO at Practically Green. So welcome, and thanks for coming out of the rain and joining us this evening. Maybe you could start off by just giving a brief introduction to your role in each of your company's startup culture, and just a quick overview so that the folks know how you participate and inspire the culture at your companies. Gary, do you want to start?
Sure. Gary Fortier, I'm at Raise Labs, and culture is the number one reason I actually joined about 6 months ago. And nothing makes you appreciate culture more than when you're in a toxic one, which is where I was before. So afterwards, I'm trying to share some anecdotes, it's much more fun to look forward. And so all of my conversations before I started, and frankly, all of the good experiences I've had throughout my career, really centered around the people and the culture and the fun you can have at work, where you spend the vast majority of the waking hours. And so before I even joined, all of the conversations were, how can we make this the best company on Earth to work at? You know, by the way, do really well for clients and ourselves too. And so everything we've been doing has really been focused over the last 6 months on the culture and how do we make this the best place to be. So for retention, for growth, for profitability, for all of those things. So all the questions we're going to be going through today are definitely resonating with the day-to-day, week-to-week activities of most of the marching orders since I've walked in the door.
Sure. Hi, I'm Ben Thomas. I'm VP of Security at Backup FI. So I joined Backup FI over 4 years ago as the first employee. I've seen Backup FI transition from just a couple guys meeting up in our bread all the way to the 55 people we are now. We actually started in Louisville, Kentucky, and decided to move the company up here to Boston, so I've seen a lot. My role initially was over product and running product, but as time progressed, I decided to specialize on the security side. It's always kind of been my unofficial role to take care of culture. I love planning fun things, and I do every month. So hopefully I can get some of those things later. But that's about it.
I'm Susan, founder and CEO of Practically Green, and Practically Green was literally to start with myself in some borrowed office space and a piece of paper and an idea, and had to build it from there. And in talking with my team tonight about big transitions, we sort of lumped it into three phases. We called it the dining room table phase, the Dogpatch Labs phase, and now sort of we're growing up phase that we're in right now. We're about to close a Series A tomorrow. We've got about 20 major clients, 9 Fortune 500s that use our product. We've really had to go from being a consumer-facing app to being an enterprise SaaS company, and that's been a transition, and so I'll be talking a lot about that tonight. One of the things that I do think makes us a little bit unique from a culture standpoint is that there's an element to our business that is about social mission, because we are a business that's about inspiring people to embrace health and sustainability at work and at home, and to change their behavior to save energy and water in the context of, I think, a lot of crazy things that are going on in this area and a lot of opportunity in this area. And so that's a huge thing that influences culture. At the same time, we're a tech company, and we've got to make sure that we build a tech culture so that we're the best place for people to work who want to work at a tech company with a mission that's around environment and sustainability. But frankly, there's only probably 10% of engineers who would say they're at the intersection of that. So how do we make sure it's a great company if you don't even know anything about the environment when you get started? And I think that's been a challenge as well.
Great. Thank you. So just to start things off and keep it really broad in general, I'm wondering, and I think the audience may be wondering too, what do you think when you think about startup culture? What comes to mind? It could be a general experience or something specific to your own company. Gary, you want to take this first?
Sure. I think startups, so we were talking before that none of us necessarily think of ourselves as startups, but I think of flexibility, I think of fluidity, I think of fun, I think of maybe not really thick, if any, rule book. That you kind of, there's a lot of collaboration, everybody knows each other, that it's very easy to be high touch, and that a lot of the things that maybe are a little bit more challenging as you grow, communication and clear direction and clear vision are a little easier when it's, four people in a coffee shop, because you know what everybody's thinking at all times, and then you get a little bigger in multiple locations. But startups, to me, it's all about the fun and the fluidity and flexibility.
Yeah, so I tend to think of culture as just a shared set of assumptions spread across the company that can allow all everyone involved to make better decisions or make decisions that are in line. And you assumptions when you don't necessarily have to have a meeting to make the right decision. A lot of people think of culture as having a mission or having a vision. Things like that, and that's part of it. I think it's important to document that. But at the same time, culture is just how do you feel at the company? How are you having a good time? Are you working towards a greater goal and accomplishing what you want to?
So I think when Corey and I first met, we talked a little bit about what I call the startup culture stereotype, which is sort of the social network movie, and you know, or at least that reinforces it. Or you know, it's two sort of mid-20s guys who have Nerf guns and run around and then invent amazing things that become billion-dollar companies, and that's how it's supposed to be done. They are not a 40-year-old mother and a 50-year-old woman whose kids just went to college and a guy who's a stay-at-home dad with who happens to be great at coding. And so we did not look like the stereotype when we got started. And what's funny is I've been in digital media for years. I was running Boston.com before I started this. And so, you know, it's not like I didn't have experience, but one of the things that we really had to do is to create our own culture for what mattered and what was going to be successful and what we thought we were going to need. And my bias has always been to focus on the customer and to really understand what problem you're trying to solve to your customer. And if you are passionate about that problem and can find these people who are passionate about that problem and solving it, and you have a real sense for how you're going to solve that differently, that you can start to build a great aspect of your culture. And so we have this sign that I literally made on like the second day of work, and it's still in the pen, and I think our first intern, who was the first employee of the company, or she wasn't an employee, she was an intern, first person of the company besides me, wrote, it said, smart, practical, helpful, fun, passionate, but never preachy. And those were kind of the words that we still to this day live by. I think the harder part was starting to realize, what do you do to create culture? What are the steps you take besides sort of having a set of values? And I think that's where we really learned what we've got, the steps that have started to build a culture for us, and then how does what work for 5 people work for 15 people? And I'm going to start to learn, how does what worked for 15 people work for 35 people? And I think, you know, you guys have experienced that much more.
Could you give us a little state of the Raise Labs address?
Can we divide everybody into pro and con, or we say kind of like the State of the Union?
Sure.
One half of the stand. So I have a slightly different perspective in that you were both, you know, number 2 and number 1 in the company, and so you saw it from its infancy. So Raise Labs had been around and doing well for 10 years before I joined. So there were absolutely, you know, cultural things everywhere. It was pretty well developed. There was a pretty strong fabric of the company. And everybody knew it, but actually it was one of the things that set me off that, hey, we have a culture, but it's a little amorphous, was Corey had come in and done a survey before I joined, and I was reading the survey on my desk. And one of the first questions was, what's the vision, or how would you describe the culture or something? And there were lots of variations of the word awesome, which was cool. So there was a lot of unanimity around awesome. But that was a little harder to maybe replicate and scale as we grow. As, okay, is this, you know, new hire applicant awesome? Is this client awesome? And of course, people had slightly different visions of what awesome meant. And so one of the things that we've done is we've talked to basically everybody in the team and said, you tell us what awesome means. And then we distilled that down to essentially your handwritten note, but for us, it's around things like quality and impact and pride and fun. And so those things were always out there, but now they've really become crystallized. And you talk about how it's a common sense, a common set of assumptions, and that's exactly what it is for us. And it's really been a great prism for us to look through as we make every decision, whether it's, you know, accept a job, or do we want to move to this place for an office, or do we want to hire this person, or do we want to, you know, anything we do. It's a good filter. So that's where we are. It's kind of a 10-year journey, but I think we have a pretty tight set of principles now that we're able to anchor on.
I'm going to interrupt and jump in before you start, just because
sure.
I've read about a lot of companies and met with a lot of founders who have told me, we created our values internally, and I've heard my team come back and tell me, I apply the values at home, and it works really well. And just when they have this idea around articulating who they are and why and how they're going to reach their goals, it gives you a set of something to focus on, and it's really interesting to hear that people bring it home with them, and I feel like that's exactly what startup culture is doing to society. We're encouraging people to think about how can we apply this to our lives and make our lives better. So I just wanted to interject. Ben, how about you? Can you
at Backup Advice. So the one thing I like to, or a piece of advice I like to give a lot of people at Backup Advice is that culture is a process. It's not something you do every one time, and then you change something, you have an event, you create values, and you expect to be done. At that point, you're not done. You're just getting started. But there's a culture of what you do every day and how you go about your day-to-day work. As we've transitioned from, three people to 10 people to 30 people to 50 people, it seems like at every transition point, I have someone pull me aside saying, hey, Ben, the culture is changing. What do we do? How do we keep that old culture? And, I'm learning myself, and at first I was trying to keep that old culture, but I quickly realized that is gone. We have to create the new culture, and we have to decide, what do we want to be next year? What do we want to be in 5 years? And we need to lay down the building block for that. So at Backupify, like I said, we're going through a lot of transitions, and in many parts of our business this year for us, we kind of called it the year of growing up. So we have real revenue, we have thousands of customers, and this year is the year we grow up. Well, it's also that's the game of culture. Last year and all prior years, I was doing pretty much everything. I was organizing everything, and now it's not sustainable. I can't do that forever. So starting this year, I pulled together a team of, now it's just three people. I start to expect to get bigger, but we're starting at three, and we've built out a culture calendar for this year. Decided who we want to be, where we want to communicate, and what type of events are going to be.
I know we've been going in order, but can I jump in for a second? I'm just totally throwing this out of whack. So your comment of that it's constantly living, breathing, evolving, but the anecdote of people say, oh, it's not what we used to be. So I've been COO at rapid growth companies a few times in different industries, and one of them we went from 45 to 125 people. And I was also at Home Depot for a number of years, which has a super strong, super strong culture and 400,000 employees, and it permeated everything. And the place where we went from 45 to 125, I heard all the time, oh, it's not the way it used to be. And what I found is everybody always thinks about the rosy things from the past. Oh, I remember when I didn't have to do, a vacation request. Well, you also didn't remember when you didn't get a bonus because the company wasn't big enough. Or our office space had rats. Or, people have a tendency to completely gloss over the bad parts of the past, which is just something you'll deal with. And it's part of growth. And it's like, well, yeah, but let's focus on the positives. Because they always bring up the one of 20 positives that was, or one of 20 things, and one was positive from 5 years ago.
So one of the things when we've been pretty deliberate about talking about culture and what we want to keep and what we want to do and what matters to us. And one of the words that I think we all in the beginning settled on was this concept of really having high trust. High trust with between each other, and high trust with clients, high trust with investors, lots of transparency, things like that. And it's interesting how that has been something that I think has, while we've had to change our culture as we've grown up, there's a few things that I think are sacrosanct that we've tried to hold on to, and that's having a high trust culture. And what that means, for example, is we don't have a vacation policy. We don't have days the office is officially closed, although I've had a client success who's like, you have to do that for SLAs. And I'm like, well, there are going to be days that it's, I guess, officially on our thing, but it's 24/7 operation. So, it's been definitely something where we've thought, hey, and therefore we have to hire people who can function in a high trust environment. And oh, by the way, if you realize when you bring somebody in that they don't function well in a high trust environment, you have to move fast to get them out. Because there's nothing that's going to destroy culture faster than a person who is fabulous at what they do talent wise, but not living up to the values that establish how it all works. And we've had one or two cases where we just made a hiring mistake and had to move really quickly to make a decision to help preserve some of those things that we think are really important. And there's other times where we're like, we just have to do that now. It's growing up. It's different.
It's growing pains.
Yeah.
So the Greater Boston Startup Culture Meetup is now close to 400 members, and we started last May. And many of us are in the midst of rapid growth and development. And I'm wondering if there's anything that's going on at Breeze Labs and Backup Plan Practically Green that's on your mind, and as you've gained momentum, what lessons have you learned in terms of amping up the inspiration and participation among your team during some of those big changes?
We've gone all in for trust. And so there was always trust, and again, it was one of those things around the defining of the culture that was always there, but it wasn't in your face. And so we said, all right, we're all in. We don't track people's time. And so somebody came up to me about 3 months ago and was asking what our rollover policy was going to be for vacation at the end of the year. I was like, I don't care. I go, do you want to take vacation between now and the end of the year? Not really. You don't. Like, do you want to? Take it. So we said, no more vacation policy. Let's just trust. If I trust you, you know, 49 or 50 weeks a year to do whatever you're supposed to do, why don't I trust you for 2 weeks? And it's not that it hadn't been explicit trust, it just we made it so. And we killed sick time, and we killed top-down reviews, and we killed all these things and just said, all right, let's completely put trust to the forefront of everything we do on the team, and the team's going to self-police. And somebody's going to abuse it at some point. And so we've kind of taken a different approach. It had been one person and two, and now we're up to 25, and now we're introducing even more freedom. So that's kind of my goal, is I want to invert the whole model, is as we get bigger, I want to have more and more freedom. Because at other companies, as I've grown, we've had more control, and that's not as much fun. And so we're going to see what happens, and we're going to see, and I'm ready to do what takes. You know, if somebody doesn't align, and the team says, hey, this person's not, you know, following the social construct, then there'll be consequences, but it's all based on trust now.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So Backify also has a what we call an unlimited vacation policy. But what was funny with that is we found very quickly that people were not taking days off.
Yeah.
But that's another problem. So we found a very creative solution for that. So we have a very, very relaxed holiday calendar. So all the regular holiday that you would expect to get off, but we've also added things like Groundhog Day,
evacuation day,
PJ's Day. Coming from Kentucky, college basketball is number one. You know, the first 2 days of the NCAA basketball tournament are off. But you know, the great thing about that, we can see the games, and usually what we've done is we have gotten everyone together to watch the games, and you know, it's great for team building, and it's good. One interesting thing about that, though, is you know now we're starting to operationalize and you know growing out our sales team, and you know it's getting harder and harder to make that fit in, you know make the larger company type stuff fit in with the fun startup type stuff, but it's a challenge today.
I think one of the things that's been interesting for us is to really think about things that we do to live, in many ways, some of the values of the problem we're trying to solve. And so one of the things that's been really fun, I'll just give you an example. Last year, we do two annual sort of on-site, off-sites that are around goal setting. So we set goals, and then we always review them as teams and together, where we are versus the goals, things like that. And then we always have something that's really fun afterwards. But last year we did a green scavenger hunt and divided up into teams and literally had things where people had to go and they had to take videos and they had to send them in and they were, you know, find a green dry cleaner and interview the owner as why it matters, which is, of course, on brand. It's tied into our product. But guess what it also did? Guess who started their green scavenger hunt on our platform yesterday? The McDonald's Corporation. One of our clients. Guess who's starting it in another couple weeks? A huge technology company. It's one of our clients. We actually productized one of our culture things, which was really cool. And, so that's gotten us thinking, you know, in many ways, we're in the business of employee engagement. around sustainability. So not only do we need to practice what we preach in terms of sustainability, but boy, we've got to be good at this employee engagement thing, which means we have to be really good at this culture thing. So it's been really fun to have that mantra around it and to be able to find those different things. And so I think, you know, as we've started to think to some extent about culture as an aspect of our product, I honestly think we pay more attention to it now than maybe we would have if we really saw it as something that enables us to be a great company, but is sort of disconnected from the value proposition to our customers.
Today we closed the biggest account we've ever closed. We've done work for them, but it's a huge deal. And one of the things, we have some performance kickers in there, and they wanted to evaluate the team, that it's a joint team as we build out a bunch of apps for them, a joint team performance. And they said, well, what should we evaluate on? And we have these things, and they're like, well, let's use our core values. So they're going to evaluate their team and our team, joint team, over the next year on our core values that we just have pulled together. And that's fantastic, right? Because they're going to be doing what we think we need to do to build the world's greatest apps. And so, exactly, totally ties in. And so the team, when they heard that today, they're like, this is kind of cool, right? Like, they're in the same boat as we are.
Do you think that these aspects of your culture are, is it easy to balance the culture internally with the demands of your mission? Or does it take over at times? I know you've mentioned that it's having this mission is very helpful in really communicating with other people who you are and attracting talent and getting people on board. You don't just attract a coder, but a coder who's green. And if you have that, does it cloud your vision at all, or does it help you steer and inspire your culture even more?
So I think one of the things we had to learn is that there just aren't enough coders out there who are passionate about sustainability to run a tech company. Fortunately, there's more and more every day that is something, and it definitely separates out candidates. When I'm talking to an engineer right now who did a Life Without Plastic blog, and he went for a year without consuming plastic. Well, he's perfect
yes.
for our company. I'm like, okay, you have found your home, my friend. I hope your code's good. That's not my job to screen that. So that's one piece of it. I think the more important piece, though, is that just because we have a product around sustainability doesn't mean we don't have to build software that provides a really fun, engaging, fabulous user experience that drives human behavior change. I mean, I could have picked easier problems to solve. Okay, build something that changes behavior forever. And so that actually takes making sure that the other parts of our culture are really strong, which is passionate. You know, another aspect is we've always been very user experience design centric and always customer feedback centric. And one of the greatest feelings I had as a founder was we just did a big customer interview because we're going to go through a rebrand, which is going to be interesting. But and we did a bunch of customer interviews, and the three words that came back from the customers about our product were, two of them are in our core values, and then one was team, and feeling like we're a team. But the other two words were fun and engaging. Notice those words aren't green and, you know, sustainability. It was fun and engaging and team were the three words that really popped about working with us. And so I think that's how our culture has ended up, it's mission for sure, but it's also really been about what's going to make for a great product in our space.
Yeah, so one of our core values at Macrofy is learning and experimentation, and that really fits in very well with everything. You know, when I was running product, you know, we experimented every day. You know, we want this UI widget or this other UI widget, or how will customers respond to this? And, you know, in the marketing discipline, you know, rather than just what we think customers will respond to, you know, it's part of our culture to split testing. And, you know, those are the type of people we like to hire. We like to hire people that experiment and people that want to learn. And, you know, one screen I have for this during the interview process is, you know, just tell me about some of the projects that you worked on outside of work. Do you like to build them? Do you like to dabble? And, you know, I found that to be very, very effective in finding the type of people we want to hire.
Do you have any last words on?
I interjected earlier.
Okay. tell us a big change that has affected your culture, and how have you made the necessary changes easier on your team? And I'll whoever wants to speak first. No rules.
I can start. So we've had a lot of changes, so I'll probably say more than one. The biggest for me was just moving from Kentucky to Boston. I'm not sure that counts because, our team at the time was, we were three people, and, when we started hiring here, and we were running a dual office for a while, which was also another interesting cultural experiment there. I think the biggest change was just when we decided to change our customer bases from, originally we were a consumer company, we were doing backups for Twitter, Facebook, Flickr, et cetera, and now, we're we back up Salesforce, Google Apps, and other sort of business-oriented tools. It's a different type of employee, it's a different type, it's a different market, it's totally different. So that was probably the biggest change.
So as a quick aside, the biggest cultural challenge I've had has not been at RaiseLabs. So if anybody is thinking about running a multinational, my last company I had about 100 employees in Manila and 100 here, and I went back and forth every month. Those are some interesting cultural challenges. Fortunately, we're not going to be dealing with those anytime soon in RaiseLabs because I'm doing everything here in Boston. But one of the things that I'm a big believer in, we're talking about culture, is I'm definitely a finance, strategy, analytical guy who's done a lot of leadership and now loves culture, is that I like comparative advantage from economics. So when I came to the company, it had been very much startup of everybody does everything, and that's great for a little while, or at least necessary for a little while. Once you get to a certain size and scale, it's usually a little better to emancipate people and focus on things they love to do and are great at. And so we changed pretty much the whole work structure about a month after I got into the company. And so that was fun. But again, it was trust, it was communication, it was a listening feedback from the team of, hey, you have to sell what you then product manage, and wow, you hate selling. So maybe we should take that off your plate and let you focus on product, which you love, and people actually really flourished. So I think the CEO is a learner of how do we sell this to people, and convince them we don't have to sell anything. If we let people do what they want to do and they're best at, and have a tendency to get there a lot faster than you can force it on them. So, big change, but it worked pretty quickly.
So I think we'd make stop tough. I'd have to stop doing QA, basically.
Yeah. Not too many people signing
really
up for that.
Yeah. There's no problem with QA.
Yeah. We actually don't have a QA person right now, so that explains it, right?
Exactly. So, I actually don't like it, but so I do think there is, when you're four people, the same stuff still has to get done. It's just you only have four people to do it, and so you don't have people who are nearly as good at all of those things or who can go as deep in many of those things. And so I do think that there is definitely a transition as you start to grow, and we've definitely felt that. And for the early employees, there's always a sense of loss, even if they hated doing
yes.
it.
Absolutely.
It's still this, but I used to be the person who, et cetera. And it's after, if you manage it well, after time, I think it's like, wow, this is so much better. But there is that sense of loss, I think, for early employees. And I think some early employees really struggle with that. For us, like Ben, the biggest transition was when we went from having consumers using our platform for their own personal sustainability journeys to becoming an enterprise SaaS model. It's private label through the enterprise. But it actually wasn't nearly as big a deal when we had small companies. It's when we landed companies like Disney and some big ones, which we landed really early on in our cycle. We had only been selling into the enterprise for about 3 months when we landed our first Fortune 500, 6 months when our second. And we had to go through a white hat penetration test on our platform. And we have been built for consumers, not to pass. Fortunately, we have really good engineers, so we actually did fine on the first pass and made the changes they asked us to make, and we're set. But, the whole workforce had to change in many ways of who would be the right people for this company. And that, for myself and my founding partners was really, really tough. And it was particularly interesting. One of my founding partners just basically said, this isn't for me. You know, the direction that we're going, I don't want to be an enterprise SaaS guy. I don't want to have this much, you know, pressure, essentially, on me from a security standpoint. He was product and tech. He's a pretty important person in that. But fortunately, he had hired folks with a sense of where we were going. And it was, in many ways, I'm going to call it both sad, but in many ways, 100% the right thing for him and probably for us as well. I think it would have been much harder had he tried to make the transition, not really been there 100% in his heart, and we've been sort of balancing that. So I think having transition at the top was important for maintaining culture, and then hiring with the sense of this is where we're going to be, this is what we're going to be doing. So every person that we're hiring now really knows that they're getting into this with the idea that, yes, we have 3.5 millions of end users, but our buyer is a corporate buyer, and our the requirements of the caliber of software we have to build are that requirement.
I'm thinking about companies that some of you have experienced this too, whether you're growing in your headcount or you've experienced a move recently, or maybe you're facing a merger. These big transitions translate to small teams experiencing an identity crisis of sorts. And I'm just wondering what can be done to lead with some courage and inspire your teams. I know we talked a little bit about this before, but in more general terms, for these big ticket items, what things come to mind when you think of this will help internally help folks be successful moving forward? And you'd also touched on, some of you touched on the point of nostalgia too.
Sure, so lots of change. I've only been there 6 months, opened an office in San Francisco, reorg, dramatically changed the kind of clients we're going after. And it sounds a bit trite, but the trust, communication, and picking people really carefully. So who's going to be the ambassador to San Francisco, and we open that office? That person has to, we talked about hiring a Greenfield employee, somebody from San Francisco who didn't know Raise Labs, and actually I said, we absolutely can't do that. Like, this person has to know the culture. So somebody who worked at Raise Labs for a few years, worked at Apple for a couple of years, didn't like the culture, wanted to come back, and we said, great, start San Francisco. That was the single most important determinant. Great engineer, great guy, but knew the culture, because we have to start someplace, and everybody we hire out there has to basically be a mini him as we continue to grow, so that I want it to be a little different, but it has to have the same vibe and openness and all the other things that we do here in Boston.
So in the 4 years at Backupify, I've worked in 5 different offices, and typically an office move for companies is a rough thing. You know, there's a lot of stuff to coordinate. You're used to one routine and then you do something else. But what I've discovered lately is that an office move is actually really good from a culture point of view. Assuming that the space is okay, even if the space is just the same, it's just a great opportunity to energize people. It's in many ways a clean slate. You can use that transition point as a way to shake old habits that you no longer want to do, and a way to adopt new ones. Now, when you do move into the new office, you have to be really deliberate about it. You have to communicate. You have to just do lots of little things. Do the things that you want to do. You can't just set up and wait for it to happen. And the one thing I've also learned is that a little bit can go a long way. Just a one extra email communication per week can make a tremendous difference. So if even if you're not in charge of culture, you're not CEO, or you don't feel like you have the level of authority to make a change, well, I say you do, because everyone can make a positive impact on culture, and communication is really the easiest way to start.
And I think, you know, speaking from the founder standpoint, there's nothing more fabulous than having somebody else want to help on this and own it and give ideas and suggestions. And, you know, it's great to have more people helping build that. And I think that's something that we definitely try and make sure that that's delegated as much as possible. Everybody's got an opportunity on it. So I'm going to actually give a cautionary space tale, just to give you a sense of something that happened in our culture. So we were at Dogpatch Labs with about four of us to start, and then we grew to 10, to the point where literally we didn't have enough desks, so we'd rotate the days people were coming in, or, you know, we'd be, like, sneaking into conference rooms to try and get extra chairs and all this. But we were all in this one space together, literally sitting on top of each other. And when we looked for space, I looked with my now CTO, and we found this awesome space, and we loved it. We had to do a little bit of work, too. But one of the things we loved about it was it had, it was a sort of a big open area, but then it had two smaller open areas, one that would be perfect for a conference room and one that would be perfect for, in his mind, an engineering area. It would be quiet, kind of out of the way, all these noisy phone people, you know, wouldn't be getting any engineer air, and that's great. So we have an engineering, so we have this room for engineers. Without really realizing it, it's starting to create a little bit of this us-them, sort of the technical people and the non-technical people. In our company, it also has to be, it's also incredibly gender. You know, most of the engineers are men, most of the non-technical people are women. And it was getting bad, frankly. Just this really, this feeling I didn't love, you know? And so I had met Tony Hsieh out at an event, and, you know, he has people rotate desks every 3 months or something like that, and I was debating that, and my CTO looked at me and was like, I'm going to kill you if you do that, because that's just not good, you know, so we're trying to struggle with this. And what's ended up happening, funny enough, is as we got bigger, we just had to start mixing a lot more, and so it was this thing we had for a while, and then, you know, we grew folks out in sales and marketing. It's now not nearly as gender imbalance there. We've added to tech, and it's not nearly as gender imbalance there. Plus, we've had to put some people who aren't technically tech in the area. It solved it, but be really careful about walls. That's because actual walls, while they seem great, can actually create physical walls can create culture walls.
And then you grow and you have floors, and floors are really bad.
And so that's a cautionary tale about it. And then the other thing is that the formality does have to change. I've found, I don't know about you all, but, you know, we never had team meetings before because we were all sitting on top of each other. We didn't have to have them. We knew what was going on 24/7, whether we wanted to or not. And now, literally, we've gone to doing Monday lunches. But something that's been fun is Monday in our world is meat-free Monday. And so we do meat-free Mondays, and it's really fun for people to get to try different vegetarian food and things like that, and people love it, and it's a great thing that's both on-brand, on mission, and also get everybody in a room so that a meeting isn't this horrible thing that nobody wants to go to. It's this, wow, we're getting this great food, and we're learning about what folks are doing.
So one thing also about the office space, and I think it falls under cautionary tale, and I'm curious, if you've done five moves that I always found it was really exciting when people get, you know, fired up and it was a fresh start, but it's sort of like when you're at a bar and it's too big and so it feels dead because it's not full. That was one of the challenges that, you know, you're bursting at the seams and people are complaining they don't have enough room, but it's also kind of cool because you're bumping into each other literally sometimes all the time, and so the communication and facilitation just happens, you can't help it. Then all of a sudden you get all of this elbow room and it feels the energy. We had to work pretty hard because the energy just felt a dip. Even though it was the same number of people in twice as big a space, it just felt kind of flat. And so we had to do quite a few things. That we actually ended up changing seats to cluster people. People were like, why are all those seats empty? We're like, trust me. We don't want to be sitting over there. Let's go. We'll go there. And one office we moved in, like, two floors, and we actually left one floor empty. And really, it was kind of tight on the first floor. And again, people complained a little bit. And I was like, there's a method to the madness. We want to keep tight and keep that vibe going.
Yeah, so on the two-floor thing, we're struggling with that now. This most recent opportunity we've been to, you know, it's closer to home, it's an easy move, it's great for us, a lot of conference rooms, which we needed, but we have two floors, and, you know, we had many debates internally, how do we deal with this, and
the initial solution that we came up with is that we have conference rooms on both floors, and you know, if you're on the first floor, you have to use the other floor's conference room, or you should be using the other floor's conference rooms, and that helps a lot. It kind of just helps people mix. And you know, obviously we have shared kitchens and things like that, so that also provides a good time to meet.
Great. I've heard a lot of really interesting culture hacks for tonight, so hopefully they make its way to the Twitter sphere. And I think I'm going to just ask one more question before we open the discussion up to the audience. So I'm just thinking in terms of the greater Boston startup community, and what are, in your opinion, how can the startup community foster more big changes and success stories? And what would you like to see in the way of access to what's happening and resource development recognition within our community?
Well, I guess one group we haven't talked about and how they impact the culture are funders. And I think what is interesting is to look at the ecosystem and the different funders in the ecosystem and how they affect the culture along with the companies and things like that. We were talking a little bit about that earlier. I'm backed by Common Angels, Launchpad, Clean Energy Venture Group, so a lot of the angel groups. And it's just been amazing, I have to say, because most of the investors are former entrepreneurs. And they know the challenges of selling in new products and building companies and things like that, and have been really, really helpful in shaping the culture and making the introductions and getting to know people and things like that. I definitely have entrepreneurs who have VCs where they feel like they're doing that same thing, and then I have entrepreneurs who I know feel like their funders really push them into directions that are not in line with the culture that they're trying to build. You know, that's something I haven't talked about, and you guys have different funding models than we do, but you know, from my standpoint, the Boston, Greater Boston community of angel investors, other entrepreneurs, tech community, other founders has been hugely beneficial for our success. I don't think, you know, I wouldn't want to start a startup in all candor anyplace else. I feel like I have friends who are in New York, I have friends who are in Silicon Valley, and I feel like this is a great place to do a startup. It's big enough to really, really matter and have the talent you need, but not so big to be impossible to navigate or as crazy competitive as California is.
Yeah, so what I find helpful is seeing what other companies are doing, going into other spaces, you know, talking to different employees of all different levels. One way at Vancouver that we've tried to help the community is we've hosted startup ping pong events. And in those events, we've had, you know, 60, 70 people come, and it's often great to hear, you know, some of the questions about the things on the wall. It's always fun to talk about, but I think for me it's even more fun when I'm out and about in, you know, everyone else's space. So, you know, if you want to see Backup Friday, just let me know, and I'll be happy to do a tour and, you know, talk about some of the stuff we're doing. But, you know, I'd like the same thing for you. You know, if you're doing something really cool, let me know.
Totally agree with that. I think that's the number one thing. So at this point, I sort of challenge myself. At least once a month, I want to go to somebody else's space. So I have a pretty good network in the ops and strategy world. And so, you know, go see somebody else's space. You know, how are you laying it out? You know, oh, top floor goes downstairs, use conference rooms. Cool, brilliant, simple, free, easy, mixing effect, love it. You know, people might complain a little bit, but it's one of those that, and all of a sudden it's a culture. A new guy comes in, they don't even care, they just do it. So I think just talking to folks, you know, talking to Corey, she's always talking to people, and we've changed a lot of things on the cultural front in the last few months, and every one of them I've bounced off an extended network of folks to just say, is this the same? And they say, well, it's a little bit the same, but, you know, let me know if it works, because it does, we'll try to do it. And that's been really good. And one point I totally agree on the who your founder or who your investors are. So, you know, if this ends up, I apologize, but I think there is a just absolutely enormous difference between somebody who's been there, entrepreneur, now in the finance world, as opposed to somebody who's just been in the finance world. I have tons of friends in PE, tons of friends who are bankers. I would never take cultural advice from any of them. I would take financial advice every single day, and honestly, they would be the guys I'd want to have help me do an IPO. But in terms of how to set up my office and how we're going to make it a green company to work at, they're not the guys I'm talking to.
Right. Well, does anybody have any questions? Albert?
It's kind of difficult to start from scratch to build a culture. My question is, did you try to say, okay, here's a model that you want to follow? Did that work?
So it's hard to start a culture from scratch. And so how do you decide what to do or how to do it? Or how
just
to
curious,
build it?
How did you do it? Did you look for a model? Like say, this company works well, let's try that. Or did you start from scratch along with all the difficulties that you have to worry about while starting a business? Or did you let it develop over time? And how long did that take?
So I think, similar to Gary, I definitely had work experiences in places that, and I've been a co-founder of a startup that I felt like had a great culture. So I had good examples of what worked. I have definitely worked with some places that were toxic, so I had examples of what didn't work. I think very deliberately, and I'm not, maybe all founders do this, but I very deliberately not only set out to build a great company, but to me, the best sign of success is if we would win a best places to work type thing when we're big enough for that to matter. You know, that it's not just that we win in our category, it's that, you know, we're acknowledged for being a great place to work. So what I ask myself is, and I think this is the deliberate founder question, is what does a great place to work look like to me? Because you have to start there.
That is, as a guy who's worked in the last 5 years for the 3 founding CEOs really closely, I mean, I would say it's the CEO. So whatever you bring to the table and what's worked and what hasn't and what you want to be, that is going to be the culture. It may deviate, but it's ultimately, I think, going to snap back to the founding CEO. And if they've done it deliberately like you have, then that's fantastic, right? Because then you can pick the best things that amplify her personality. But it doesn't deviate far from them.
The one thing
in my experience.
Right. The one thing I'd add, though, is just because it's a great place to work for me didn't always mean it was a great place to work for people who were different than me when we started to grow. And I think this is one of the places where we really had to allow for the flexibility. My schedule, because I have 2 young kids, is I work from like 5 to 7 in the morning, and then I'm with my kids, and then I get in, but I'm like on that train at 6 o'clock, so I can be home for dinner. My engineer can, you know, several of my engineers can't function before 11 a.m. It's just they're on the 11 to 8, 11 to 9 shift, you know? And so having an early culture would just be toxic for having a good engineering culture. So we had to add tons of flexibility around hours and just work when you work and get your work done. And if I don't see you, that doesn't mean I don't trust you. You know, that's what I trust. The other thing that was that we just had from the beginning is it wasn't a big deal in the first iteration of the dining room, which was working from home because I was home. I was at my dining room table. but when we got office space, it was, you know, I was like, you know what? Work from home Fridays is something that is really important to me. So I'm just going to say we're going to work from home on Fridays. Well, we're now 18 people, and we all work from home on Fridays. And we use Campfire, and we use Basecamp and Skype, and it just works for us. What's been interesting is that doesn't mean people can't work from home from other days, but there's really a sense of a cultural obligation to be there Monday through Thursday, and it's the exception, not the rule, so that we are having a collaboration time. But it was very deliberate about some of these things. And then there were just things that emerged, like the guys downstairs do Scotch O'Clock, you know, Terrible Labs, and it's fun and it's really good, but that meant we didn't want to have something on Thursday nights because it sort of conflicted, so we went for Wine Wednesday, you know? And just little things that emerged out of the situation that you were in.
Yeah, so in the early days, culture really was not deliberate. We were building a product for a market that really didn't exist. We believed it would, we thought it would, and, you know, luckily it worked out. But we really weren't delivered our culture, and I think that was a mistake. And that's what I would change. If I were doing it again, day one, you know, I would want to have it on my mind and
like you said, be deliberate. I would want to write that down as soon as possible, just so that every person that we hire, we make sure that they are aligned with what we're doing and you know, we're all working together.
Yeah.
Thanks. Susan, you gave a couple of examples of where market demands forced you to wrestle with certain aspects of your culture. You talked about quality and the SLA. I wonder if there are other examples of where you've had to really look at the desired culture versus the market demands.
We are all about quality and creativity, which we love, but sometimes clients want on time and on budget a little bit more than quality and creativity. And that, I think, is probably an inherent tension in every client engagement we do. And it's a balancing act, and that's part of the fun, I guess. And I think we've been able to successfully, because it's such a part of who we are, convince clients that the quality and creativity actually should, in most cases, trump maybe their little bit more myopic budgetary concern, specifically around the timeline. But it's always a tension, every single engagement.
So one area that I have to focus on balancing is flexibility and security. As VP of Security at BackUpify, you know, security is my number one thing. It's, you know, it's hard to sleep at night sometimes. And, you know, I want to sleep well, but at the same time, you know, our engineers want to take shortcuts to get things out faster. And, you know, how can you be this loose environment where, you know, you can do anything and you can try anything and you can use bleeding edge software, but at the same time, have a rock solid, stable platform that's secure. And, you know, I feel like we've managed it well. You know, I'm a big fan of risk management. I like to know what our risks are. I'd like to, you know, address those risks. You know, appropriately, not too much control, but just enough. And it's a struggle every day.
Yeah, I mean, I think our biggest, I guess some examples, but the biggest thing where we really had to change the culture was when we realized that in order to support the kind of clients that were interested in using our product, that the whole approach to our platform had to change. And we actually, you know, not only did we have to build a new platform that was really enterprise caliber, we had to build it really with now much more of a mind towards security, much more of a mind towards integration with corporate environments, so single sign-on and things like that. That in the consumer environment, we would have, you know, we were putting all our effort into building the platform that the employee would want to use. You know, this is fun, this is engaging, I'm learning things. But, you know, when we went in and now, you know, the buyer has to get approval from their IT department, and usually we have to go through some, like, 70-page application and fill it out and do all that. We really did have to change. And we had to change, you know, without losing the nimbleness and the agility that really marks us. And what's been really fun is we just hired somebody awesome who came from SuccessFactors, which is a huge enterprise SaaS company. And he started when there were 20 employees and stayed through the IPO and SAP acquisition. And he came and he said, you know, the thing that we need to figure out how we hold on to as long as possible is the nimbleness. Because that's the thing that makes startups win. How do we do all the things we need to do from an enterprise standpoint while keeping that agility and keeping that nimbleness? And I guess that, I think, is going to become a huge emphasis is just how do we do both?
I was wondering if you've had any experience trying to develop a company culture while dealing with a virtual team of founders. That's kind of where I'm at right now, and it's, you know, my CEO, he's in Pennsylvania, our other co-founder is in Florida, and I'm in Boston. Our company, we're a hiring platform that's very, our mission is very focused on social justice and equalizing the playing field for applicants, so I feel like our culture is kind of implicitly built around making things fair. But how do you try to develop a culture within the team when you're not working together and we're dealing with very separate issues? Like they're taking care of the Microsoft partnership in India, and they're like, Christina, you deal with the US. So we don't really even speak that much together. So it's kind of wondering if you've had any.
Yeah, so I can talk about that a little bit, and this comes from the early days. So, you know, as I mentioned previously, we at one point we had dual offices. We had an office in Cambridge, or the original office in Louisville, and then at that same time we also had four engineers offshore in Ukraine, and so we had these three locations at once. And the way we got it together was having an IRC channel. Or having, you know, some sort of chat room available at all times. So when you're working and when you're on, you're in that channel, and that channel becomes the water cooler. That, you know, that you're sending, you know, questions. You're sending, you know, you may send a funny article. Or you may send. It's everything. And you know, at one point we were even doing a Scrum. So you know, for those who aren't in engineering or product, a Scrum is just kind of a really quick update of what you did, what you did yesterday, and what you plan to do today. So we would do those in IRC, you know, at 9 a.m. You know, happened to be the time that worked for everyone. You know, we would all paste our three sentences in there, and you know, we would instantly know what everyone was doing. But I found it really cool.
We went from a couple companies ago. We had an office in Boston. We opened one in San Francisco, Houston, Chicago, Calgary. I had remote employees in Nevada, Vermont, Pennsylvania, Florida, and this all happened in probably about a year and a half. And so there were a few things. First of all, it's not as strong of a culture, I didn't find. I mean, you do lose a little bit of translation. Our turnover of remote employees was higher. Despite all the things I'm about to say, it was a little bit higher in full disclosure. One was we spent a little bit more money. We flew everybody back once a month, and we had a co-location. And on the first Friday of every month, everybody came back, and we'd have a company meeting, and we'd go drink beers, and they'd stay the weekend in Boston. And that was a definite cost. But when you think about the cost to it was all engineers, et cetera, the cost to hire, train, keep on board, it's worth the flights, right? So we did that. I personally would call people once a month. Every single one of those remote employees just had a one-on-one. Hey, how you doing? What are you working on? How's this project going? Etc. Tons of Skype. Tons of chat. I mean, just constant. The channels had to be open. We had one of our product owners in Vermont, and his product team was here in Boston. So he just lived on Skype. It has to also be a simple message, right? That's where I really learned about distilling the message down to simple things. If your mission statement is 17 paragraphs, it's going to be a little harder to screen for that when you're hiring for that remote employee for Chicago, and then they're never going to get it. Whereas if they can remember two or three things, then chances are they have something that resonates with everybody else they're working with. But it's a lot of time and effort.
So one quick funny story. There's a company on the West Coast, I'm not going to mention their name, but they have, or for every remote employee, they hang an iPad on the wall. And they have a webcam going. So you could walk up to that employee at any time and talk to them. I love that.
Great. Well, I'm going to cut it short now because it's getting a little late. And I want everybody to have a chance to ask their questions. So please feel free to just talk to Gary, Ben, and Susan during the next portion of our show. Thanks for coming, and it's great to see you in the new year, and I hope to see you again at future meetup events. Stay tuned for upcoming events. Thanks.